The Pat Kenny Show on News Talk
with Matter Private Network. During current restrictions, don't ignore your health concerns. Our expert team is ready to help.
Well, now we're joined by Professor Luke O'Neill, a professor of biochemistry at Trinity College in Dublin. Luke, good morning.
Good morning, Pat. How's it going?
I'm going very well. Now, one question which came in yesterday, kind of a comment really, and it was about the different vaccines. And the guy said, okay, so we'll have the Pfizer vaccine, the Rolls-Royce for the medical professionals and the frontline staff, and we, the plebs, will get the Morris Minor, the AstraZeneca. What do you say to a comment like that?
That's not the case. I mean, they're pretty similar. There's small differences. I mean, the trials show that Pfizer was, 90% efficacious. AstraZeneca is around 70%. That's not a huge difference, you know. And then once you go out into the big population, I bet they'll be quite similar. There's no question this AstraZeneca vaccine is very efficacious. So there's no concerns about taking it. I suspect it'll be the same in the end, you know.
Okay. And of course, it's easy to distribute because it can be stored in the pharmacy fridge or in the GP surgery fridge. And I think you told us before there have been no adverse reactions reported, so you don't have to hang around for 15 minutes.
That's right. That's a positive for definite. Yeah, there's no other allergy at all to the AstraZeneca one. So again, I think I wouldn't call it the Morris Minor. I mean, the Pfizer one does look pristine, doesn't it, at that 90% level. But guess what? In Israel, as they're giving it to millions, the efficacy is slightly lower in the wild, as it were. You know, they may both settle down at about 70% efficaciousness is one prediction.
Yeah, which would be grand then.
Be great, effectively.
You've immunized the bulk of the population and the pandemic calms down. That's the theory.
Exactly.
Any further news on whether or not protection is afforded by the vaccines from spreading it to others? I mean, we were talking the other day about monkeys harboring this in their throats, maybe, so they don't get sick, but they still have a bit of the virus in their throat and they can spit it at you. Do we know what in the wild, as it were, how the vaccines are behaving in terms of spread?
Yeah, again, a good trend there. Remember, the Israeli spot have done 2.7 million people now. Isn't that incredible in terms of the number of people vaccinated? And they're watching these people like a hawk. They're taking swabs from their noses just to see if they're getting infected after the vaccine is there. And at the moment, it looks like as if the first shot is stopping transmission by 33%, which is really great, you know. Now, remember, the second shot is needed, and that might go up even higher. So that one's heading in the right direction. At a minimum, even if you get a bit of virus in your nose, it'll be less than if you're not vaccinated. So the dose you're spreading is going to be less. So again, it's becoming less of a concern, but still we don't fully know, and it's a work in progress.
Yeah, because the whole thing of the vaccine passport, if you're still capable of spreading it, even though you're not suffering yourself and you're totally impervious to any effects of the virus, it's no damn good if you're sitting beside someone in a plane and there's little bits of virus heading your partner's way.
Yeah, the Australians are now discussing this, Pat, because they'll have to keep their quarantine rules is one worry they have. If the vaccines don't stop spread, people may have the passport, they're let in, but then they might still spread it, you see. So they're watching that very, very closely. But as I say, the hope is, and certainly, Pat, the other vaccines coming down the track, and I know they're a few months away, but some of those are predicted to stop spread, you see. So eventually we will have vaccines that will certainly stop spread. It just might take a bit of time to get there.
Now, you want to give us an update on therapeutics, both the known ones so far and the ones which might be on the way.
Yeah, I think it's very important to remember people are still in hospital, as we know, and that will still continue. I mean, obviously, the vaccine will decrease that, but they're still trying to get treatments to help people who are in hospital. And then secondly, to stop people developing long COVID, this long term problem, you know, so still massive effort there. And one good one was the U.S. administration has just bought 1.25 million doses of the Regeneron antibody cocktail. Remember, Trump was given this cocktail himself. They just bought this a massive amount. They've spent $2.6 billion on this. Can you believe it? With the company Regeneron, they'd given them $450 million anyway as part of Warp Speed. But this will be used in 300,000 people. It decreases the viral load tenfold, the latest study suggests. So there's a big advantage. Wow. Now, the problem is it's expensive. So the question is, how do you get that to give? It's not like the vaccine, like it's really expensive. It could be 20,000 per patient kind of thing. And in America, they're clearly going for that. It also decreases any medical visit by 72% if you give it to people early. So these antibodies really work. And the question is going to be, how do we get enough of them into the hospitals, I guess? And then a second one is the Gilead drug remdesivir that we've discussed before. That's now made nearly $3 billion in sales, to give you an idea. So it's being widely used in America. 50% of people in hospital in America now given it, you know. So again, we're seeing these therapeutics, I guess, being rolled out more and more. And it's important because obviously enough, if we still see people in hospital, you want to treat them and again, decrease mortality in that way.
Now, not everything is a success. There's a company called Alexion, which paused the enrollment of patients in a study of a particular drug that they were hoping would do the business.
Yeah, it's still a bit of a work in progress. There's about 1,000 trials running with different therapies still, remember, and some of them aren't working. And this happens in this business. But yeah, a drug that stops the thing called C5, maybe Alexion, looked good early on, didn't meet the endpoint in this trial. And this can happen because sometimes, you know, the hypothesis mightn't be quite so good, or it could be the wrong set of patients you're giving it to and so on. So that trial has stopped. So they're not all working, basically. But one other one, Pat, that I think is really worth mentioning is a company called Synergen. They are giving what's called inhaled interferon. Now, as you may remember, your immune system makes these things called interferons. They block the virus on contact. They're very powerful antiviral molecules. Children make loads of them, which is one reason why we think kids are more protected. As you get older, you make less, and that could be a reason why older people don't do so well. So, of course, they said, why don't we give some to people? So now they're giving it as an inhaled form, and there's a massive trial running, and there's optimism with that because you're kind of making older people then less vulnerable, if you see what I mean, by supplementing them with something that they're missing. And that's a really interesting trial. And again, the early studies there look very positive, you see. So that could be another possibility, that as soon as you're in the hospital or wherever, even if at home, you might take a shot of this up your nose, and the interferon would help stop the virus in your upper airways. So again, all these studies are going full steam ahead.
Yeah, and inhaled doses, a well-understand protocol and technique. Yeah. So dose sizes and all that, very much like asthma inhalers, they can be monitored very carefully, and it can be DIY, which would be very important. Yeah. Now, new variants, and people are concerned that the vaccines won't be effective, and, you know, the virus is changing all the time to beat what humankind is coming up with to try and defeat it. Where are we with which vaccines might be most effective against any changes that the virus might come up with?
Yeah, there's a frenzy of activity on this, but you wouldn't believe the amount of stuff I'm getting in the last couple of days, because obviously that variant B117, which was started in the UK, that's now in 50 countries, including in Ireland. There's a South African variant as well, B1135. They've got names now. There's a Brazilian one. And it's a cause for concern. There's no question about it, because they spread more, as you know, and that makes it more difficult to control then. And what that tells us is we must double down on all the measures, because here's a strain that's spreading more, and it doesn't make you any sicker, which is good news. But it's a numbers game, isn't it? So the more people who are infected, the more illness you're going to see. So it's really important. The Germans are really on top of this. They're looking this closely. I see Angela Merkel has just said we should all wear surgical masks because they're more powerful at stopping than the cotton mask, for instance, because of these new variants. Because obviously, if it's spreading more, we might need to be even more careful in the measures. But you're right, but the big question is, will the vaccines work against these new ones? And again, there's evidence they will, which is good. Pfizer yesterday announced that their vaccine works against the UK one. But it's one to watch, Pat, because these viruses are clever and they can evolve and dodge the immune system. We know this from previous pandemics. So it's a really important thing to keep a close eye on.
Yeah, the question of people's immune systems, I mean, if you've got a robust one, does that encourage the virus to mutate, or is it more likely to mutate if you've mounted a fairly weak reaction to it?
Yeah, it's the latter. So, and they think the UK one grew in an immunosuppressed person who couldn't contain the virus, and the virus went chronic. And remember, every time it divides, it makes an error, you see, and that error might be to an advantage. It's a random thing in many ways, you know. So you can imagine if the virus is dividing over a series of weeks or months in an immunosuppressed patient, the chance of a by dumb luck, really, another one emerging that's a bit more infectious, there's a risk of that. And they reckon that might have been what happened here. And then, of course, it's evolving in a way to make it more effective, but it's random. You know, one gets selected that happens to be more effective at spreading, and that could be where that one has come from. So it's more to do with the immunosuppressed population. But it makes the vaccine rollout even more important, remember, to get it done quickly. To stop this, you see, because obviously we really need to ramp up, and every country is saying this, if we can speed up the vaccination campaign, because that will stop this spreading, just like the other measures are.
Yeah. So if we get enough of the population vaccinated very quickly, the virus has nowhere to go, kind of thing, and therefore it will fade away for the moment. And then whether we need an annual vaccine, all of that will emerge in time. Now, your mucus, not a pleasant topic perhaps, but people are spending their days analysing mucus.
They are. This is a fascination if you're a biochemist like me, Pat, because even though we don't like mucus, do we? You can call it spit if you like. But a really good study, they took nearly 2,500 samples of mucus from people with COVID-19. They had 2,000 controls to compare it to, and they assessed the mucus very, very carefully. And what they found was fascinating. They found there were 375 proteins in the mucus of the COVID people and not in the normal mucus, if you see what I mean. And then they're wondering, what do those proteins do? Now, this could be used maybe diagnostically, as we've often discussed, for instance. It can also tell us about the immune system. So it turns out that there was a protein called complement was in the mucus. Now, if you're an immunologist, we work on complement a lot. The complement helps antibodies do their job. It complements the antibody. That's where the name came from. So it's a good sign to have it in mucus. And it just shows you how mucus is beneficial, because it can. You would think it's a bit of a crude thing, wouldn't you? But there's proteins in mucus that are fighting the virus. And that's a really good thing to have. So again, they're looking more and more at what might be the optimum mucus, if you like, or at least, you know, could be mimic mucus in some way as a possible therapy. So it's a really active area. And again, it just shows you how complicated biochemistry can be, because there's something like, if you blow your nose, you're blowing into your handkerchief a very complex mixture of biochemicals that's bringing you all kinds of benefits. And in the case of COVID-19, just as much mucus is a really good defender.
Okay, so people who kind of tried to cough and spit the mucus away, they might be better off leaving it there.
Yeah. In fact, the virus wants you to cough it out, because it spreads, remember, through droplets. So now, of course, you can't stop coughing sometimes, but no, mucus is your friend. And again, Pat, a reason to wear a mask, because that keeps the mucus moist in your nose and in your throat, you know, and then the mucus is there to fight the virus. So it's yet another reason why mask wearing is seen as a good thing.
Your sense of taste and smell, we're told that, you know, on the ads, if you have an altered taste or smell, then you should get yourself checked out. You may have COVID. What does altered taste and smell tell us about the progress of the virus?
Well, again, another fascinating study just came out 2 days ago, and I thought it was well worth talking about. Now, it's a really robust study. They took 2,500 patients and in 18 hospitals and assessed their sense of taste and smell. Now, 73% have a smell defect, and that just tells us how common that is. That's much higher now than flu. People lose their smell and taste with colds, of course, but it's much higher than those diseases. So again, it's a real hallmark, if you like. We knew already, but that kind of confirmed that. 46% had a taste problem. So that was less common, strangely, and you might think the two are connected. I thought it was interesting, Pat, how they assessed the sense of smell. That sounds like quite a nice thing. They had 22 different odors that the people smelled: orange, turpentine, peppermint. So it sounds like quite a pleasant thing, doesn't it? But they could assess who had lost their sense of smell. Now, very interestingly, with severity, taste and smell came back. Isn't that strange? And that was unexpected, because they thought it might be the other way around, you know? So it turns out if you've lost your sense of taste and smell, you may be doing better, you know, with the virus overall. If that's not a feature, or it begins to come back, that might mean it's heading towards a more troublesome disease. So again, they're considering this to be a good kind of prognostic. We call this a prognostic indicator, by the way. So it's interesting, isn't it, the way it differs. Diabetics, they lost their sense of smell and taste for definite. So that really associates with diabetes for some reason. And of course, they're in a high-risk group. And then females were inclined to lose it more than men. So again, there's some kind of sex difference there. But this just shows you the amount of effort that's going into studying these different features of the disease.
Now, some of the questions coming in, could you ask Luke about reports that in vitro trials indicate that the Pfizer vaccine is not effective against the South African version? You mentioned their press release yesterday that said it's very effective against the UK version.
It's a work in progress, but as I said earlier, there's a huge amount of effort trying to address this. Because obviously, if one vaccine doesn't work, you want to stop using that vaccine and use another one, or you want to change the Pfizer vaccine. The other somewhat good part is it'll take Pfizer 6 weeks to make a new vaccine. Just say the one that they have doesn't work as well. They can make a new one within 6 weeks and then bring that one out. You know, so it's a very important question. But that person's right. There's some evidence in a test tube the antibodies are less effective against the South African strain. Now, they still work. They still neutralize, but you need more of them. Now, what that might mean is in a person, you may make more of it, you know, and that should be OK. So even if the antibodies aren't quite as good, they can still do something of a job. And the second thing that's good is the T cell part. We don't know yet, but that might be normal. So even though they're testing antibodies and there might be differences, your T cells might still be able to fight the virus. This just shows you how elaborate the immune system is, but it's got loads of weapons, you see, because it had to evolve them over millennia, I guess. So, but it is a work in progress that we still don't fully know, if the truth be told.
Antoinette asks a question we've asked before, but it's worth repeating. If the vaccine is, say, AstraZeneca, 70% effective, does that mean that if I'm vaccinated, there's a 30% chance I can still contract COVID? Or does it mean that out of every 100 people, 70 of them will be perfectly protected and 30 of them won't?
Yeah, a better way to put it is it just decreases the risk overall. So in a population, say, of 100 people, you know, there'll be a 70% decreased risk of one of those people getting infected. That's the way to think of it. It's all to do with risk, really. Decreasing risk is what it's all about. So it's a little bit more complicated. It's very statistical, really. But, Pat, the current flu vaccines only work at 60% efficacy, and they're really good. You know, they work well. They're used widely. So that's the way to think of it, really. It's a decrease in risk.
Israel is practicing medical apartheid. Palestinians are being ignored. This was not even practiced in South Africa, says Ken and Tala. The WHO have raised the issue. Israel should not be praised for its behaviour in this pandemic. I saw the candidate who's running against Netanyahu, and he said, well, the Palestinian Authority has autonomy over this. He says, we're willing to help, but they're not part of our programme.
It's a very important point, but they've got to vaccinate widely there, and they'd be foolish not to, because it can come in from Palestine, can't it, and from the Gaza Strip and so on. And I'm not aware of any active effort not to vaccinate, but I don't know, to be honest. I know they're trying very hard to vaccinate the Arab-Israeli population in Israel, and the reluctance to take the vaccine there, for instance. But it's still that's a serious point. We look at Israel as the canary in a coal mine now, because they're vaccinating so widely. We learn from Israel about what's going to happen here. Let's say they prove that it stops transmission. That'll be very useful for us to know that. But it's a serious point. I think they should be getting the vaccine out widely in that part of the world, you know.
Yeah. That report about Angela Merkel suggesting that medical-grade face masks rather than cloth coverings could become mandatory. France is looking at it as well. What Angela Merkel is saying is that either single-use surgical FFP1 masks or the more protective FFP2 filtering facepiece respirators should be worn in the workplace, on public transport and in shops. So...
We may head in that direction. We may do. I mean, the point about this is all those measures, we need to be really zealous with them and follow the guidelines. Even more importantly, there's a virus out there that spreads more readily. So double down on everything, if that means wearing a more robust mask. I mean, I'm sure some of the 3-ply cotton masks are probably as good as the surgical ones, you know. But certainly be careful with the mask wearing. Make sure your mask is effective is the message, really.
Okay, and a final question from a listener called Pat. Why can't we share vaccine info for each country so they can produce it themselves? Why does it always have to be about money for the usual suspects? Treating it like a generic and give you the formula, off you go.
At the moment, of course, what happens is when the vaccine gets approved, they've gone into those factories and made sure those factories are perfect, basically. So you can't just set up a factory somewhere else and make the same thing. That would take time and it has to be regulated, you know. So at the moment, they have to be made in like Pfizer has all those plants that are fully vetted, if you like, you see. So that's what's going on there. But it is somewhat of a good point. I mean, we're just waiting now, aren't we, to get access, I suppose. And the more, if I could wave a magic wand and vaccinate the entire population, wouldn't that be brilliant, you know? It's just a question of logistics now, really.
So get it done and get it done quickly. 70% of adults in Europe to be vaccinated by summer is how the EU put it. So what that means, May, June, July, I don't know, but we need to do it as quickly as possible. Luke, thank you very much for joining us. That's Luke O'Neill, Professor of Biochemistry at Trinity College in Dublin.